Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome to Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry, sitting in for Mark Bayshore, who's out on vacation this week. Coming up on today's show, we're going to preview the Lansing Symphony Orchestra concert that's happening this weekend. And we're also going to look at how MSU became one of the most racially integrated football programs in the 1960s. But first, last week, a state-appointed review team assessed that Detroit is sinking into fiscal disarray. Since then, Governor Snyder has been mulling over whether to appoint an emergency financial manager to the city. Today, he is expected to announce that he will make an appointment. With me in studio to discuss the future of Detroit's finances is Eric Scorsone, an MSU economist who specializes in municipal finance. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
All right. So first, let's recap a little bit. So last week, the financial review team releases this report. What is in this report that makes Snyder start taking these steps? What does this report say about Detroit's financial situation?
This is the second review team report. There was one last year that led to a consent agreement that's been in place for about a year now. This report basically said that as of this last year, there really is still no plan to fix the city's financial crisis and that the city's long-term liabilities are over $14 billion. And under those conditions, the review team believes there is a financial emergency. And if the governor agrees with that, which it appears he is going to, then the next step would be the appointment of the emergency financial manager.
So aside from the obvious fact that Detroit is in a fiscal kind of fiasco at this point, why right now? It seems almost a little rushed because this financial situation didn't just happen overnight. Detroit, like you said, it's been like this for over a year since the last time they reached some sort of consensus. So why are they pushing through this appointment right now kind of quickly?
Well, I think there was a growing consensus that there was a continuing cash crisis and that the city was simply unable to move forward. And so at some point, you can wait till they run out of money, but I think the feeling was that they had to move quicker and that certain conditions were just appearing that this was really going to become a major problem, whether it's cash flow or again, that, the long-term liabilities, just, really more forcefully recognizing that in this report as opposed to the last one.
Now, in March, I know that a new law regarding the emergency financial managers will go through. What's the difference between how it currently stands and how the law that's going through in March works?
Right. So in November, the voters turned down Public Act 4, which was our emergency manager law. And then at that point, we went back to an old law, Public Act 72, which was from 1990. And that's the law we're operating now. The new law goes into effect March 28th, so we have a lot of complications. So this process is occurring under the old law, the Emergency Financial Manager Law. And if the person is put in place before March 28th, then they would be grandfathered in, as we call it, as an emergency manager starting March 28th under this new law known as PA 436. And they would actually have expanded powers from what they would have as of today.
So what are those powers that they would have?
Well, today the emergency financial managers do not have, for example, the power to terminate or reject or change union contracts. And that's probably one of the main differences right now. And that's a very important power because a lot of these cities' financial problems are around employee compensation and retiree payments. So that's what emergency managers had under Public Act 4, which was rejected by voters. That will be back in place as of March 28th. And so that's probably the biggest difference between them. There are some other smaller ones, but that's going to be the big change coming.
So in light of the findings of this report, it's kind of my impression that the governor has two options here. So consent agreements are off the table, basically at this point. Didn't work in April. Probably not going to work this time around. So they can either appoint an emergency financial manager or appoint a manager who then recommends that the city go into bankruptcy. So is that kind of your impression too of the of what's going on, of what the two options are?
Right. An emergency manager can recommend a bankruptcy filing. The governor does have the power to veto that, but I think depending on who they appoint, that will tell us something about whether they do think bankruptcy is at least a possibility. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion at this time, but I think people are looking at that because it may be that even the emergency manager with their expanded powers cannot ultimately fix the city's problems. And so that's going to be the question, I think, going forward over, say, the next 6 months, probably.
So take us through what this emergency manager is going to have to deal with. What's the scenario? What are some of the challenges they're going to face as they come into their position in Detroit?
Well, the challenge is they're going to have face massive crisis, very little money, and really a very broken system of government. And that's not something you can easily fix overnight. So they're going to have to look at all the consulting reports that have been done. What kind of team do they need to put together? And how do they get a handle in the first couple of months over, most particularly, paying the bills, cash flow? And so that'll be their first challenge, getting the right people, addressing the restructuring. There's already a number of consultants working right now, you know, companies like Ernst & Young. And so seeing what are they doing, what are their plans and recommendations. And then the question is, okay, if we solve that short-term problem, get through the fiscal year through June 30th, what about these, you know, $14 billion in long-term liabilities? How do we address that? You know, that doesn't have to be done in 3 months, but they're going to have a plan. And does that include bankruptcy? Because bankruptcy is very complex and will require a lot of discussions and discussions with all kinds of creditors. Or are there other options? You know, and do we try those options first? And so they're... It's a very big job. It's going to require a lot of digging in on a lot of long hours because it's such a large government and such a lot of complex issues that have been building for many years.
It seems like another potential issue could be lawsuits. I know when Flint had an emergency financial manager initially being dragged in and out of court for things, it looks like people on the Detroit City Council are already looking for legal action or to take legal action. Do you think that these lawsuits could potentially, you know, prohibit anything from really getting done because there's so much challenge to the position in the first place?
Right. That's going to be the biggest risk. All emergency managers, whether it was Pontiac, Flint, Benton Harbor, most of them have been sued many times over actions they've taken. Sometimes they've won, sometimes they've lost. So, and Detroit, given the size, the complexity, the type of city council they have, there's going to be legal challenges almost definitely from unions, from other organizations. And so the emergency manager is going to face a lot of legal challenges, a lot of legal bills, going to need large legal staff, either in-house or outsourced. And that could slow up any fixes the city may need. And that's, again, why, you know, you look at bankruptcy, you look at other options to see, you know, legally what's going to hold up. If we do terminate a union contract, you know, do we get sued and then does that get overturned? You know, those are all risks that the emergency manager is going to have to factor into what they're doing.
And that recently happened in Flint, correct, where they tried to terminate some contracts and went to court, overturned.
Right. So, and they'll appeal that decision. But again, and Flint has many similar problems, you know, large legacy costs around retirement payments. And so that's a indicator that this is going to be potentially a very challenging environment that the EM is going to be operating in.
Now, you already touched a little bit on the difficulties of if the option is to go into bankruptcy. But what if that's a decision? What if that's what they decide to do? What does that look like? Are there any other precedents that we can kind of look to for other cities that have been in similar situations?
Well, it's pretty rare municipal bankruptcy, but there have been a number in the last few years. Stockton, California, San Bernardino, California, Vallejo, California, Central Falls, Rhode Island, and Jefferson County, Alabama are some of the best known. In some of those places, they had similar problems to Detroit, even though most of them were small, much smaller than Detroit. And in some cases, they did get significant reductions in their pensions or retirement health care costs, which allowed the city to remain solvent. And so there's some precedence that maybe this is a pathway. It is very expensive, millions of dollars in legal fees. It may take several years. And in that time period, the city's still going to have to operate. The court isn't going to give the city money. So the city will still have to function somehow. It'll have to find the money to pay the bills. Also, there's a lot of misunderstanding about bankruptcy. The federal judge isn't going to order the sale of the Detroit Institute of Arts or the bus system. That's all going to be up to the city to make a plan to say, here's our plan, judge, to fix our problems. And then the judge looks at the creditors and who's owed money and decides, is this a fair plan? And there's a lot of, you know, legal wrangling, but basically that's the process. It could be very expensive. It could be very costly. And it could have an impact on the state of Michigan as well. But the question then is, what are the benefits? And there may be substantial benefits to a bankruptcy potentially.
Well, it sounds like either way Detroit goes, it's going to be a challenge ahead. Thank you so much for coming in. This is Eric Scorsone. He is an MSU economist and an expert in municipal finance. Thanks for joining us and talking about Detroit's financial situation.
Thank you.
Honey, let's make everything all right. Oh, Lord, baby.
The art of Japanese woodblock printing is rare, but a new studio is bringing an ancient tradition to Lansing. Last week, I went to Linda J. Beeman's studio to learn more about the traditional art of mokuhanga.
All of these on this wall are a series I did on the Shiawassee River.
The artwork lining the walls of Old Town's newest gallery is a fusion of East and West, Michigan nature displayed in traditional Japanese style.
I do mokuhanga, which is Japanese woodblock printing.
That's Linda Beeman, artist and owner of Linda J. Beeman Studio. The mokuhanga art that Beeman prints is unique, as only about 100 people outside of Japan work in the traditional style. Beeman was hooked on mokuhanga after participating in a workshop.
There's something about each process for me, whether it's the carving or the brushing on the wood or the pressing of the baren into the paper. For me alone, doing it, it's very peaceful, and it is something that just touches my soul.
Making a mokuhanga-style print is labor-intensive. The woodblock paintings are traditionally made in an assembly line fashion, but Beeman does every step on her own.
Okay, I start with just a basic watercolor painting of what I want to communicate.
The painting she shows me is blocks of greens and yellows and grays, which make up a mountain range and a valley below.
I break it down into each color. So I start layering the colors on the drawing to figure out how many wood blocks I need. And then I start carving.
Finished carving, Beeman pulls out a little square brush. It looks like something you would shine your shoes with.
I put pigment onto the block, just watercolor in a tube, or I have dry pigment that I got in Japan. And then you brush it in, and it's kind of hard to explain, but there's a certain dampness that it gets to that you know it's enough and it's time to print that sheet. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Beeman lays a piece of paper down onto the color-saturated wood. She grips a small circular disc called a brennen and uses it to press the sheet into the block, transferring the color into the paper's fibers. And then so it's transferred on. The yellow is now on the paper.
And that's how it's done.
For each piece, Beeman carves about 6 to 8 blocks, which will take her about a week. Then she'll spend another week printing. So to get from initial sketch to final print, it can take Beeman anywhere from 3 weeks to a month. But Beeman's time working has been worth it. Mokuhanga has taken her halfway around the world. Last year, she was one of six artists to reside at Mount Fuji, selected by the Agency of Cultural Affairs of the Government of Japan.
It was such a huge honor. And to be able to work with five other Mokuhanga artists from different countries and learn about their cultures and eat meals that they cooked. And it was a very international residency. It was a really special time.
Beeman is trying to create a similar experience for others through an artist exchange program called Art from the Lakes.
Specifically, it's with Shiga, Japan, which is Michigan's sister state. And we're sister states because the largest freshwater lake in Japan is Lake Biwa, and Shiga surrounds it.
This year, Shiga artists will come to Michigan for an exhibition. And in 2014, Michigan artists will have a chance to share their art in Shiga. Beyond her work on the artist exchange, Beeman is trying to share Japanese culture with the Lansing area. In March, she's holding a Japanese tea and sweets tasting to benefit the Art from the Lakes project. She also plans to teach Mokuhanga classes in the spring.
It'll be very small classes. Probably only five or six people will be able to do it at a time. But I hope someone will fall in love with it like I have and continue on.
That was Linda J. Beeman's studio, a piece on Mokuhanga there. I went to her gallery earlier this week. Now, though, it's time to talk sports. We have Joe Rexrode of the Detroit Free Press here to talk sports with us, as he does on Fridays. Hey, Joe. Hello?
Hello. Sorry.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I never had the chance to talk to you before, so I'm excited. Let's talk sports. So March is upon us, and the madness has already basically descended. This week, we had two big upsets in the Big Ten. First, Indiana fell to the Gophers on that court that I hate. I really dislike Minnesota's lifted court. Anyway, so they lost to the Gophers. And then we had U of M was taken down by Penn State. What do these losses mean for the Spartans and their chance of winning the conference this season?
Yeah, well, Minnesota's loss certainly has an impact on that. Minnesota's upset. I must argue with you. It's one of my favorite places in the Big Ten.
I think it is so weird.
About Williams Arena.
I think it is so weird. I think it's dangerous. No.
it is a little weird. You're right. The court itself. Yeah, it is a little. Yeah, especially sitting there. I've sat there courtside before, and it's like, you know, everyone's like 12 feet tall. But
yeah.
But that win for Minnesota, of course, keeps Michigan State's hopes alive. They were really, really slim before that. And now, you know, Michigan State still would need Indiana to lose another game. And there's certainly no guarantee of that happening. And Michigan State would have to win all of its games and has some very tough ones ahead. But at least there's a chance still. And then Michigan's loss, that just maybe affects seeding for the Big Ten tournament or in the NCAA tournament, but Michigan certainly now would need Indiana to lose twice for the Wolverines to get the title. But Michigan does get to play Indiana once, so at least would have control of one of those games, yeah.
So Michigan, U of M's chances are looking kind of slim to take the season then.
Yes, yeah, very slim, yeah. I mean, that's one of the most shocking upsets of the entire college basketball season. Penn State 0-14 and down 15 in the second half and somehow coming back to beat Michigan. So it'll be interesting to see how Michigan recovers from that Sunday against Michigan State.
Yeah, we've got another big game in Michigan, the two teams going up against each other for the second time. Now, last time that the two teams met, MSU blew out U of M, essentially. Are we going to see a similar game on Sunday, or are these going to be two different teams meeting up?
Yeah, I definitely don't think we're going to see a Michigan State blowout again. It's hard to gauge how Michigan will respond. I mean, I think Michigan's confidence has to be broken a little bit. And really, since you know, the Michigan State loss was the third in four games, and one of them included a half-court shot from Wisconsin. I think that whole stretch really hurt Michigan in terms of overall confidence. But Michigan State has lost two games in a row as well, so another team that really needs a win. They both really need a win, and neither of them are playing their best basketball of the season right now. But I think with the home crowd and with the motivation to, you know, I guess redeem themselves from that first game, I think the Wolverines will play much better and much harder and be much more aggressive. And I think you add it all together, I think it'll be a much closer game.
Well, let's look at some of the key factors that MSU going into this game, knowing it's likely going to be a lot more difficult than the last one. What are some of the key things that the Spartans have to do to get away with the win?
Well, they have to try to play defense the way they did in the first meeting. That was, I think, easily the best defensive performance of Michigan State's season. So it'll be hard to duplicate that, because I think when you play in front of your home crowd, I think you just get extra energy. I think the crowd was an absolute factor in the first meeting. It just gives you a little bit more, and maybe it demoralizes your opponent a little bit. I mean, Michigan had 16 turnovers in that game, which is very uncharacteristic of the Wolverines. So, you know, without that extra help, Michigan State still has to manage to bring that energy on defense. Michigan State did a great job of getting offensive rebounds the first time around, and what that does is it prevents Michigan from running. Michigan State did not let Michigan get out in the fast break, and that's a big key against Michigan. So, really, you do a lot of the same things, and you have to hope Michigan isn't red hot from outside. I mean, Tim Hardaway Jr. was 1-for-11 in that first game, and you can't expect that to happen again. So, you know, and offensively, I mean, Michigan State did not have a great game the first time around. It was a good game. But in this game, the Spartans are probably going to have to, you know, hit more jump shots to win.
Yeah. Speaking of offense, Keith Appling has been pretty absent on the offensive end for Michigan State. I guess, what's going on with Keith Appling, or what do you think is going on with Keith Appling? He just doesn't seem to be that present in some ways.
Yeah, it's a daily question on this beat now. And, you know, Keith, I mean, yesterday after practice said, well, it's probably a little of both, a little bit mental, a little bit physical. I mean, there was a thought, does he have some sort of injury that, you know, that no one's talking about? But I don't think that's it. I think he's been worn down a bit. I think his backup, Travis Trice, missed four games with concussion-like symptoms, and that meant more minutes for Keith Appling, and I think that maybe took something out of him. But I also think that when, as a player, if you are not making shots, I think it adversely affects the rest of your game. And I think you saw that Sunday against Ohio State. He's now 9-for-39 in his last four games. And this happened to him last year. I think, you know, the wear and tear of running a team, being the point guard, having to guard the other team's best player, and then also hit some shots, I think that is a lot on a player, and I think when those shots stop falling, that can really affect you. So I think that's really what it comes down to. But Michigan State needs him to at least get back to playing his normal defense and run the team well and get other people shots. And if he can hit some shots, that's a bonus, and that might be what it takes to win Sunday. But at least they need him to get the first two things back, and that does not, you know, shouldn't, you know, lean on making shots.
Okay, so who wins real quick? Who's going to take it?
I don't know.
Oh, come on, Joe. Come on. No.
Oh, man. Well, you know, right now I still think I slightly favor Michigan in this game. I just think Michigan will really, really bring everything it has to this game. I think that was a really humiliating night for Michigan and Breslin, and I know the Wolverines aren't playing well, but they are much, much better at home. So right now, I would have to give a slight.
Okay. Well, all right? Well, I'm disappointed, but you're entitled to your opinion. Thanks for talking with us, Joe.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Emmanuel. Good talking to you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to speak with ESPN.com's Adam Rittenberg about MSU's integrated football program in the 1960s. I'm Emmanuel Berry, and you're listening to Current State on WKAR. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry, subbing for Mark Bajor, who's off someplace warm, and I'm jealous. Anyway, moving on. The year was 1966. Two undefeated football teams, Notre Dame and Michigan State, were playing for the national championship.
People have called it the dream game of the century, and in my long association with football, I can't think of any game that has ever attracted the national attention as this game has. Dick Kenny at the 40, and he's ready. There's the kick. High end over end, being taken by Conjar at the 14-yard line, back to the 15, 20, and to the 27-yard line.
The entire nation was tuned into the game, witnessing not just the clash of helmets and bodies, of fighting Irish and Spartans, but of segregated and integrated. In 1966, the Fighting Irish had only one black player on their team, while the Michigan State Spartans were one of the most racially diverse teams out there. Adam Rittenberg covers Big Ten football for ESPN.com. He recently published an article about the legacy of Michigan State's integrated football teams during the 1960s. He joins us now from Chicago via phone. Adam, welcome to Current State.
Oh, thanks for having me, Emmanuel.
I'm absolutely thrilled. I loved the piece that you wrote on this. So let's get right into it. So in 1960, MSU has a team that's it's extremely diverse in the 1960s, both racially and geographically. So players at Michigan State, they're from places like Texas and the Carolinas. How are we getting these players to come to State?
Well, you know, again, a lot of those players were from areas of the country where it was still segregated and couldn't play for the major teams in their states. You know, so Bubba Smith, for example, a great player from Texas, who wanted to play for the University of Texas but couldn't because he was black. Jimmy Ray from North Carolina, who couldn't play for NC State or University of North Carolina because they were segregated. So they were looking for some place to play, and Duffy Doherty, the coach for Michigan State at the time, you know, cast a very wide recruiting net. You know, he looked for these players. He had connections with coaches in those parts of the country, both the black high school coaches and some white college coaches, you know, who saw these players, who would love to have had those players on their team, but wanted them to have opportunities. So they almost ushered them to Duffy Doherty and Michigan State. And you know, again, at that time, the Big Ten was really the conference of opportunity for black players everywhere, especially from the South, because they would have a chance to play, and it was really the only opportunity for some of these elite players who wouldn't be able to play for the top schools in their state. So that's how many of them ended up at schools like Michigan State, like Minnesota, which is another great program in the 1960s, like Iowa, Wisconsin. Quite a few Big Ten programs really took a lot of these players from the South.
Now, Duffy, he didn't only venture to the South. He also went recruiting in Hawaii. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, yeah, it was something I was hoping to get into this, a little bit more in the story. But, you know, yeah, he regularly brought in some Polynesian players from Hawaii, a couple every year. That they played big roles on these national championship teams. You know, and again, offering them the opportunity to come to, you know, a good school like Michigan State to play football at, you know, at that time in the best conference in the country. And you know, you just had this mix. You know, it wasn't just white and black. You had Polynesian, and as you mentioned, it wasn't just Northerners. You had a lot of players from the South and obviously from Hawaii. So it was just a team that, again, kind of reflected a country that was in the process of changing during the mid-60s.
Now, at the time, I'm sure that, as you mentioned, there's other programs, Minnesota, Iowa, that are also recruiting players from the South. What about Duffy and MSU made players want to come and play for the Spartans?
Well, first of all, Michigan State has a long tradition of offering opportunities for black players. You know, the first quarterback to play in the Big Ten was Willie Thrower. He played, great name too for a quarterback.
Yeah, great name.
so he came to Michigan State in 1950, and he actually was the first black quarterback in the NFL after that when he went to play for the Chicago Bears. Also, Gideon Smith back in 1913 was one of the first black men to play college football at a major level. So Michigan State had this tradition. And then I also, you know, from talking to the players and one of the former assistants at that time, you know, Duffy Doherty's personality, I think had a lot to do with it. You know, he had the ability to go into really any home, you know, white, black, north, south, or even in Hawaii, and connect with the recruit, connect with the parents. Like I mentioned, he had a lot of these friendships with coaches from other parts of the country, Bear Bryant from Alabama, Daryl Royal from Texas, Spud Wilkinson from Oklahoma. All those programs weren't taking these players. So I definitely think his personality had a huge role in being able to bring in so many of these elite prospects. And what he would do, you know, there'd be these coaches' conventions around the country where the black coaches weren't really allowed to participate. So he would have separate clinics for the black coaches, make relationships with them through those clinics. That's how he got to know Bubba Smith's father, who was a great high school coach in Texas. And then that obviously led to Bubba Smith coming to Michigan State. And then Gene Washington, who Bubba Smith had played against, they kind of got him to Michigan State through that connection. So I think that the Doherty's personality, his openness, and then certainly sending assistants around the country to the Carolinas, to Texas, and so forth, led to the surge in players from the South.
Now, these players coming up from the South, they're coming from Jim Crow South, you know, separate drinking fountains, essentially treated as second-class citizens. And talking to these players, what was it like for them to come to East Lansing?
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a culture shock in certain ways. You know, the climate was a culture shock, and for a lot of them, you know, like Gene Washington, for example, not only did he not play against any white players or with any white players in high school, but, you know, he grew up near Houston, and he barely interacted with any white people. So coming to Michigan State, you know, they put him in a dorm with two white swimmers from Indiana. Obviously, he had many white teammates with the Spartans. He was now playing against white players in the season. So, you know, that definitely was a bit of a change. But again, from talking to a lot of these guys, it almost seemed like you know, a lot of the issues that were going on in the country, the activism, the rioting, the tension didn't seem to exist in Michigan State. There weren't a lot of racial issues. There was nothing really on the team. You know, things like interracial dating were discouraged, one of the players told me, but you know, it wasn't an environment where they felt you know, marginalized or tense. They really enjoyed it. It was almost this utopia, you know, in a country in a country where college campuses were extremely
vital at that time.
Right, yeah. Right. Many of these guys didn't even want to go home. They enjoyed their time at Michigan State so much.
So the 1965 and 66 seasons are some of the most successful in MSU history. And at the time, there's still kind of this hesitation, even in schools in the North that have black players, to play more black players than white players. It's kind of a token athleticism, if you will. And Michigan State was going out there and playing, you know, eight black guys and three white guys. This team kind of really crushes that stereotype. Do you think that they recognize the significance of what they were doing as they were doing it?
They definitely did not. I mean, that was something that, you know, again, as they become older, as they've been removed from the game and can look back at the history, or even a guy like Sherman Lewis, who played in the early 60s and graduated by the time that game of the century took place in 66. You played that clip, you know, even for him watching from home and seeing the contrast of Michigan State against a Notre Dame team with only one black player and Alan Page, that sort of hit home. But for the guys playing at the time, you know, again, like I said, you know, there weren't major racial tensions on campus. There weren't any on the team. They were just playing the game. They're trying to win games. They're trying to go to the Rose Bowl. But when they look back on it now, I think they really see the significance historically of what they were able to do in that time period.
Now, what Duffy was doing at the time, people weren't always happy with it. I read about some incidents where people were like, I'm going to stop cheering because you're playing too many black people. Was he taking a risk in what he was doing in the 1960s?
Well, sure. Again, there was prejudice at the time, and I think it did take some time for some people to warm up to this idea, that this changing team that you're looking at every Saturday. But, you know, again, I think, you know, he looked at it as, hey, I want to give these guys opportunities. They're all great players. Let's make our program better. Let's make Michigan State a destination for players who weren't having these opportunities elsewhere. And listen, it led to national championships. And again, a couple of the players talked to me about a culture of winning. It sort of blocked out everything else that was going on around the country, the civil rights movement, the rioting on campuses elsewhere, the tension. Because they were winning, everyone just kind of came around, and they were singing, they were enjoying it, they were had the great chance at the games. And so I think when you know, again, winning kind of cures everything in sports, and that I think that definitely changed opinions when you know they started to have the season they had in 65 and 66.
A recipe for success there. Well, Adam, thank you so much for chatting with me. Adam Rattenberg works for ESPN.com. His recent article is Spartans Blended: Race in the 1960s. And to take us out, we have Coach Duffy.
Go right through for MSU. Watch the points keep growing. Spartan teams are bound to win. They're fighting with the vim. Rah, rah, rah. See their line.
During the season of Lent, selling fish is big business. Restaurants aren't alone in tapping into the fish feeding frenzy. Lots of churches, and not just Catholic ones, serve fish meals this time of year. In Lansing, St. Casimir's Catholic Church on Sparrow Avenue takes it to another level. WKR's Scott Pohl reports.
It's the noon hour on a Friday during Lent, and people are in line to pay for a fish lunch at St. Casimir. Lots of local churches serve fish dinners during Lent, but St. Cas might be the only church in town with a lunchtime schedule, too. Father Bill Luger is pastor at St. Cas. He says serving lunches isn't the only thing the parish does to counter the competition.
We hold our own because we're one of the few that have smelt, and people come far and wide for smelt.
And I think they may start coming for the baked, not fried fish.
Yes, baked fish is new this year. I've been trying to get them to do that, and they finally recognized that the pastor had a good idea and doing that. So I'm working on baked potatoes, maybe for next year or later this year.
St. Cas will also serve fish meals on Good Friday, which many churches don't do. St. Casimir will serve up to 200 lunches on a Lenten Friday and between 400 and 600 dinners. Those figures don't include takeout orders. The parish also delivers fish meals to shut-ins and to the Mother Teresa House for people with terminal illnesses. Who's doing all the work at these meals? Volunteers like Julius and Kathy Maurer. They've been married for 50 years. Every Friday morning during Lent, they work with a crew of about 30 people cleaning smelt.
Well, some of the friends come and they say, hey, come on down and help us out. So they didn't have anything to do on Friday morning, so we come down and helped out. It's gotten to be a tradition now. We have a pretty good time. Yep.
Last week we were here from 7 o'clock until noon. It's opening the fish up and cleaning the inside out.
So your fingers may have touched the fish I just ate, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Almost certainly. Well, it was very clean.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
An entirely different crew comes in to get ready for the dinner hour. Ronald Cox is in charge of the lunchtime crew. He says the lunch service began over a decade ago when volunteers prepared noontime meals for police officers and firefighters who would be on duty and unable to have dinner here.
That's how it started. And then about 5 years ago, we decided, well, we would man up so that maybe we could serve a couple hundred meals at lunch to cut down on the crowd at night, because the lines used to be like 30 minutes long. And we're down to about 10 minutes in line now at night.
Non-Catholics often wonder why Catholics avoid meat on Fridays during Lent. Father Luger says the practice helps people connect with the events of Good Friday.
Lent is prayer, fasting, and abstinence, so the church asks that we abstain from meat on Friday. People who are over the age of 60 or who are infirmed, as well as children under 8 years old, do not have to follow that. So it's a way of gently reminding us of that great gift.
Not everyone who eats at a Lenten fish fry is motivated by that. Meet Jim Rosinski, who lunched with his wife Sally at St. Casimir.
It's not that important to me. It ranks way down on a list of things you should or shouldn't do. But I come with Sal, so yeah.
Sally Rosinski thinks the healthier option of baked cod might entice some people who don't care for fried perch to have a meal here.
I had the smelt. I like smelt. I have to admit, I didn't take the baked.
Oh, you didn't take the baked. So here you are bragging on the baked and you didn't have it yourself.
I'm happy to have it because a lot of people have said that it's all fried. Everything's fried. Let's try something else. So, and I hear it's going over good.
With devout Catholics and fish lovers alike hungry on a Friday during Lent, there's one thing you can be sure of. Finding a fish meal is easy, but the demand is great. A little patience can be rewarded with an enjoyable meal at churches and restaurants all over Lansing. Reporting from St. Casimir Parish in Lansing, I'm Scott Pohl for Current State.
The Lansing Symphony Orchestra's Masterworks 5 concert is Saturday night at Wharton Center. WKAR's Melissa Benmark previewed the concert with composer Brian Gaber, who wrote one of the pieces in the program, and with conductor Timothy Muffet.
Barbara wrote two essays for orchestra, and they are very much representative of his orchestral style and his orchestral voice, which really didn't change much over the years compared to many other American composers who went through many different phases. Barbara seemed to be fairly consistent. And I think what I really find interesting about this piece is that he calls it an essay, and that when you think of a literary essay, it's a work that is on one subject. And that's what he does with this piece. There's one musical idea, which is the basis for the unfolding of the whole work. The whole work's only 8 minutes long. It's short and compact and based on one idea rather than what we find in so much music, which is the dual themes, contrasting themes. And this is one musical motive that he develops through the course of the whole piece. It's kind of an interesting design and way of thinking about constructing a piece of music.
The Symphony No. 9, the New World Symphony by Dvorak, is on the program. What do you find charming and challenging about this piece?
Well, the perspective we're bringing to this program is that this is an all-American concert. We have Samuel Barber, we have Brian Gaber, a living American composer, and we have Antonin Dvorak, a visiting American composer. And this is, of course, the work he wrote when he was visiting the United States. And there's a real connection for me between the Dvorak and between Brian Gaber's work, and that's why these two are on the same program. When Dvorak came to the United States, he was, as probably many of your listeners know, was brought here to help American composers learn how to write quote-unquote American music. And to make a long story short, Dvorak said, if you want to find the heart and soul of American music, you're going to look to the music of the African American and the music of the Native American. And I feel that in Brian, as a 20th and 21st century composer, has done exactly that. And he's really followed what Dvorak set out, what he said is what American composers should be doing. And Dvorak wrote a uniquely American work. All of the thematic material in that is derived from the spirit of the African-American music and spirit of Native American music, all the thematic material. Sometimes we lose that because it's framed in such a Eurocentric musical style. Sometimes we lose the American qualities to it, and I think that's our job as musicians, is to keep that strong through the choice of inflection and tempo and rhythmic stress. We can make sure that the spirit of that music stays present in the course of the piece. I think it will be a fresh experience because you will have heard something of a descendant of Dvorak's edict to American composers before you hear his work.
One of the things that strikes me about the New World, and again, this could just be me reading into it, it reminds me of friends of mine who have come from New York who like Michigan, and I say, you like Michigan? You're from New York? And the Dvorak piece has almost this, I don't know, boyish enthusiasm or something about it, of seeing, it's like he's seeing it just through delighted eyes.
Absolutely. And there is, you know, Dvorak, and one of the things that actually makes him challenging as a composer is that it's very hard on the sleeve in a way, in that there's a certain directness to his music that is very grounded and very simple and just straightforward. And I think that that's what we're seeing in that.
So we go now to composer Brian Gaber. You are based out of?
Tallahassee, Florida, Florida State University.
Tell me about the poems that you based Ancestral Waters on.
Well, there's two. The first one is a poem of Langston Hughes. It was written in 1919, I believe, and that's called The Negro Speaks of Rivers. It's the first poem he ever had published, 17 years old. And it talks about his relationship to the physical land. He was traveling with his father up the Mississippi and seeing the image that he says that is really moves me is he says that he sees the river as being like his veins and the blood flowing through his veins and how other rivers have been important to his ancestors. He talks about the Congo and the Euphrates and the Nile.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
The second poem I actually looked for in relationship to the Langston Hughes poem. I've been aware of Langston Hughes for many, many years. And the second poem, I wanted to find a poem by an African. And I found a poet named Joe Coleman DeGraft, who is from Ghana, which is one of the countries where slaves were taken. And he talks about standing on the shore of Africa, looking back to America and looking at the path where his people have been taken. And I think the most important point for me is that I don't know what any of this is like. I can't hope to experience it. But what I can hope to do is just musically set it in a musical setting that is as respectfully and emotionally as I can. So that was my goal.
And interestingly, it does incorporate kind of some of that old world, new world thing mm-hmm. that the New World Symphony has. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because with anything I do, a lot of things, terms come up like jazz influenced. And it's jazz influenced, but only because I'm jazz influenced. It's what I grew up with. And Tim and I were just talking about Porgy and Bess. And so much of Gershwin, you can hear he was trying to sound like African-American music of his time. That's very different than what I tried to do. I tried to just sound like me and let it support the poems.
So tell me about the shape of this piece.
Well, it's three movements. First, we have the Langston Hughes poem, where he speaks as an American. And at the end of that, the second poem has no words. It's just what we call a vocalese. Allison sings it without any text.
That's Allison Sanders.
Yes. And that sort of frames it with the other poem. Now, the second movement we call prayer because it's just this voiceless kind of hope. Not that things will be better, but that things will never be forgotten. And that's sort of my motive behind the whole thing.
When did you write this?
I wrote it about 2 years ago. And it came very quickly. The whole thing was written in about maybe 4 to 6 weeks, which is unusual. It's a 20-minute work. But it just seemed to – and this is not normal for me, but it seemed to just kind of come at its own pace. And as I tell children sometimes who are interested, usually what I do – and maybe it's getting older, that when I write music, I get an idea and then I just want to get out of the way and let the music do its thing. And if I try to force it to do something, it'll probably not work out so well.
That was Brian Gaber. He wrote Ancestral Waters, which will be sung by soloist Allison Sanders at tomorrow's performance. Before that, we heard from Lansing Symphony Orchestra conductor Timothy Muffet. They spoke with WKAR's Melissa Benmark. Well, that is it for Current State this Friday. It's been a pleasure to be your host. Mark, if you're listening, we survived, your show is still intact, come back. No, Mark will be back on Monday. And you can catch me, though, if you want to. I'm the host of Current State Weekends. That's Saturdays at 11 a.m. and Sundays at noon. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Emmanuel Berry, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.